The next case on the docket this morning is 520-0261, People versus Thompson. Arguing for the appellant, Travis Thompson, is Richard Whitney. Arguing for the appellee, People of the State of Illinois, is Jennifer Camden. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note only the clerk is permitted to record these proceedings.
Good morning. Mr. Whitney, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, counsel. Richard J. Whitney for defendant appellant Travis S. Thompson. Your Honors, this appeal concerns whether Mr. Thompson has satisfied the low threshold of presenting a colorable claim of actual innocence, not for purposes of getting any immediate relief, but solely for purposes of being permitted to file a successive post-conviction petition so that he may be permitted to fully present his argument for a new trial. I submit that it is abundantly clear that he has satisfied this threshold and that the court below committed numerous errors in coming to the frankly astonishing conclusion that he had not. In a murder case, in which the victim, Orlando Clark, died from a stab wound inflicted by a knife or knife-like instrument, Mr. Thompson was convicted primarily on the basis of testimony from three witnesses: a cousin of Clark, who said he saw him with a silver object; another cousin of Clark, who said he saw him stabbing someone else with a black-bladed knife and then jabbing and swinging the knife at Clark; and Clark's girlfriend, who said she did not see a knife, but saw Mr. Thompson apparently stabbing Clark, making jabbing motions. Despite various inconsistencies and contrary evidence that provide some reasons to doubt their testimony, this court ruled on direct appeal that this evidence was sufficient to sustain the conviction, and I am not here to try to relitigate that. As emphasized in our reply brief, however, even where the evidence of guilt is overwhelming, as the state contends, new evidence of actual innocence under the Robinson test by our Supreme Court will satisfy the requirement for filing the successive petition alleging actual innocence if it raises the probability of a different outcome. In other words, the question really here is, does it add something to the defense side of the ledger? Does it move the needle? In this context, it clearly does. We have a defendant, Mr. Thompson, who has consistently maintained his innocence and testified to same at trial, and he has now presented new evidence that constitutes substantial additional reason to doubt that he was the one who inflicted the fatal stabbing injury to Clark. At trial, no one testified that anyone else was armed with a knife or stabbed anyone. But now Mr. Thompson has presented the sworn testimony of his co-defendant, who admits to having a knife and using it against his assailants, the principal one of whom, everyone agrees, was Clark. He also presented the sworn testimony of two other witnesses who heard co-defendant Patrick Green admit to stabbing two people immediately after the melee, as well as testimony from Mr. Thompson's mother, Juanita Bradsfield, that provides additional reason to doubt the testimony of Clark's girlfriend. If such evidence had been available at trial, it obviously would have changed the complexion of the trial and added substantial weight to the defense side of the scales, and yet the court below found to the contrary. As explained in the briefs, it advanced specious reasons to come to the astounding conclusion that the other person charged with the murder, now admitting having a knife and swinging it against assailants who must have included Clark, wouldn't have affected the outcome. In doing so, the court below also committed patent errors of law in relying on the inapposite Sanders case and in finding that the Green affidavit was positively rebutted by the record because of contrary witness testimony. Yet as our Supreme Court held in Robinson, contrary witness testimony is not grounds for denying an actual innocence claim, and to hold that is fundamentally illogical, since the whole point of new evidence is to contest the evidence at trial. In fact, each of the affidavits that Mr. Thompson submitted contained evidence that was newly discovered, material and not cumulative, and of such conclusive character that it could lead to acquittal on retrial, which is all that Mr. Thompson had to prove at the motion for leave stage to file a successive post-conviction petition. He does not have to prove his innocence at this stage. It doesn't have to, he doesn't have to prove that the outcome would have been different at the motion to leave stage. He just has to prove that it could lead to acquittal on retrial. And I submit that it's rather plain that this evidence could. So there's a three-part test. Was the evidence new? Was it something that was unavailable at the time of trial with the application of due diligence? And with respect to each of those affidavits, Your Honors, Mr. Thompson has clearly shown that, because again, we have to accept his allegations that they were as presented in his motion and petition and in his motion to reconsider, unless positively rebutted by the record. None of these,
Mr. Whitney, except for the Green affidavit, which that was his co-defendant, why were the other affidavits unavailable?
Well, Mr. Thompson explains in his petition and the motion to reconsider that he did not learn of them until they were presented to his post-conviction counsel, Christian Burrill, several years later, at the time when he hired Mr. Burrill to file his post-conviction petition. The affidavits, well, we've already covered Green. As far as Bradsfield, this was when he first learned about it. There is no evidence to contradict that his allegation that that's when he learned about it. And at this stage, we have to assume that his allegations are true, unless positively rebutted by the record. There is nothing in the record to suggest that Juanita Bradsfield's information about how the witness Labatt, the Clark's girlfriend, had essentially been bribed and threatened in order to give the testimony that incriminated Mr. Thompson, was not learned until the time that this information was presented to Burrill several years later. With respect to the affidavits of Cobb and Schoff, those are the two people who testified that Clark admitted to stabbing two people, or excuse me, that Green admitted to stabbing two people immediately after the melee. They did say in their affidavits that they told Bradsfield before the trial, but there is nothing in the record to suggest that Bradsfield actually communicated this information to the defense or was able to communicate this information to the defense prior to trial. So again, the assumption would have to be at this stage that Mr. Thompson's allegation is correct, that it was not imparted to the defense or to him prior to trial. It may be that if once the petition is allowed to be filed, the state will have every opportunity to challenge this and try to make the case that it was available. But we're at the motion for leave stage. The assumption has to be, unless positively rebutted by the record, that what is stated in the petition and in the other documentation is correct. And at this point, we have to assume that it was not available to the defense prior to trial.
Does he get that presumption merely by filing the petition?
He gets that presumption at the motion for leave stage. Yeah.
The motion stage.
Yes. So that's with respect to all of that, it was newly discovered. It's clearly material and not cumulative. Even the state doesn't argue that this is cumulative evidence. It tries to argue that it's not material. But obviously, having someone that says, well, the state's chief witness was approached with a bribe and a threat, the co-defendant admitting having a knife and swinging it at his assailants during the melee, and two witnesses saying that he admitted stabbing two people immediately after the melee, all of that is materially not cumulative. All of it could have moved the needle if allowed to be presented, and therefore is sufficient to establish a claim of actual innocence at the motion for leave stage. I see that my time has expired. If there's no other questions, I'll save further remarks for rebuttal.
Thank you. Justice Welsh?
No questions.
Justice Moore?
No questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Whitney. Ms. Camden for the state?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Jennifer Camden on behalf of the people. I'd like to first address the state's arguments that the affidavits were not newly discovered. As to the affidavits filed by Bradsfield, Cobb, and Schaff, the trial court correctly ruled that they were not newly discovered, meaning that the defendant did not meet his burden of showing that the information in them was discovered after trial and could not have been discovered earlier through due diligence. And as to Green's affidavit, it also was not newly discovered because it was available at the time of the prior post-conviction petition. Now, the parties disagree about whether the newly discovered showing must be made in the motion for leave to file the petition and its supporting material, or whether the showing may also be made in a defendant's unsworn motion to reconsider the denial of that motion for leave to file. But under either analysis, the defendant has not met his burden. The motion for leave to file contained only vague and non-specific assertions that the material was newly discovered and presented no factual support for that conclusory assertion. And that is insufficient under Weidman and the other cases cited in the People's Answer Brief to meet the defendant's burden of showing that the material was newly discovered. Now, the defendant's reply brief argues that sufficient allegations appear in his motion to reconsider. On page C-755, he states that he became aware of the information in all of the affidavits, including Green's, in 2015 when initial post-conviction counsel Burrell was retained and was made aware of it. The state addresses the defendant's citation of this source at pages 30 and 31 of the answer brief with regard to all of the affidavits at issue. This allegation was not in the defendant's motion for leave to file, and even if this unsworn assertion is considered in the analysis of whether the defendant met his burden, it's still doesn't explain trial counsel's lack of due diligence with regard to the information in the affidavits of Bradfield, Cobb, and Schaff, as discussed in the state's answer brief. The defendant argues at pages 5 through 9 of the reply that trial counsel didn't lack due diligence if he failed to obtain information directly from state witness Labatt. But the defendant's three affiants, Bradsfield, Cobb, and Schaff, were on the defendant's own witness list. Bradfield was the defendant's mother. Cobb and Schaff stated that they reached out to Bradsfield and that they were at the courthouse ready to testify at the defendant's trial. So even taking the motion to reconsider into account, the defendant still has not presented specific well-pled facts showing that their information could not have been discovered through due diligence in interviewing defense witnesses. And it is the defendant's burden to make that showing here. A presumption cannot fill that gap. And separately, regardless of the defendant's failure to show due diligence as to the information in 4 of those 5 affidavits, the motion to reconsider affirmatively shows that no affidavit, including Green's, is newly discovered, because the general rule is that to be newly discovered, information cannot be available at the time of the prior post-conviction petition. And that's in the Weidman case discussed in the People's Answer Brief. Now, the parties disagree about whether that general rule applies in this case. The defendant in the reply at pages 11 through 16 argues that the Weidman rule is a quote outlier based on flawed or distinguishable cases, and that this court should disregard it and follow an appellate court decision in the case called Warren. However, the rule in the Weidman case is still good law, and the court in Weidman justified it by citing the Illinois Supreme Court's goal of avoiding piecemeal post-conviction litigation. That's at paragraph 58. Also, it's not an outlier. It's the general rule. As stated by the defendant's own cited cases, the Warren case at paragraph 114 acknowledged that, quote, typically evidence of which the defendant was aware in earlier post-conviction proceedings will not be considered newly discovered. The defendant's other cited case, the Ayala case, also acknowledges that that's the general rule, and that's at paragraph 139 of that case. And in both of those cases, the Warren and Ayala, the appellate court explicitly stated that it was departing from the general rule in the unique circumstances and in the unique instance of the presented by those cases. In other words, those cases were explicitly limited to their facts. And this case is factually distinguishable from the Warren case. If time
Ms. Camden?
Yes.
Why was the Green affidavit available at the post-conviction stage?
It was available at the post, well, according to the defendant, it was available at the post-conviction stage because prior post-conviction counsel Green was, prior post-conviction counsel Burrell was made aware of the information in it. The record also shows that the Green affidavit was executed 3 days after the initial post-conviction petition was filed. So evidently
Burrell didn't use it and didn't relay that to the defendant. So do we impute that to the defendant in this case?
I'm not sure whether the motion to reconsider states that Burrell didn't impute it to the defendant. I mean, the motion states that that the defendant was aware of the information and also that Burrell was aware of the information. Regarding whether we impute it to the defendant, yes, the actions of counsel are actions of the defendant. And the inquiry is whether the information was previously available. And this information was previously available. I'd point to the Weidman case for the discussion of the standard that applies here. I'd also note some distinctions between this case and the Warren case, in which the appellate court held that the evidence was newly discovered because of initial post-conviction counsel's deficient performance in failing to present it in the first petition, and that performance can establish cause as to why the claim wasn't filed earlier. I'd note that the defendant's opening brief in this case at page 21 explicitly disclaimed any reliance on cause and prejudice principles. I'd also note that in the Warren case, the initial post-conviction counsel filed an actual innocence claim that was based on the information that would have been contained in those affidavits, but that counsel in that case unreasonably failed to attach them. Here, the defendant's initial post-conviction petition did not claim actual innocence, so the defendant is not arguing that counsel's presentation of the claims that were in that initial petition was deficient. So that's another distinction between this case and that. Also, the record in the Warren case was more developed than the record here and proved that initial post-conviction counsel was aware of the information. Here, we have only defendant's unsworn claim in a motion to reconsider. So the record in this case is less developed. I'd also note that not every door was closed to the defendant in this case, unlike the defendant in Warren, who tried to obtain new counsel. And the appellate court recognized that the defendant had done what he could to avoid this exact result and tried to cut him a break. But here, the defendant did not raise those complaints in initial proceedings. So for those reasons, the Warren case is distinguishable and the general rule should apply. And of course, even apart from whether the affidavits were newly discovered, they still must be material and conclusive. And in this case, the affidavits were neither. I'll rely on the people's brief for the discussion of the conclusiveness or lack thereof of Bradfield, Cobbs, and Schaff's. And briefly discuss Green, the non-conclusive nature of Green's. But I also want to respond to the defendant's argument that that affidavit need only, quote, move the needle or lend some weight to the defendant's argument, or that it could lead to acquittal on retrial. And that material is contained in pages 23 and 29 of the reply brief. The Robinson Court, the Illinois Supreme Court in 2020, stated that the inquiry, even at this stage, is whether the new evidence, when considered along with the trial evidence, would, quote, probably lead to a different result. So that's cited as the standard at paragraph 47 in Robinson, and that probability language is repeated throughout the opinion. So the analysis, even at this stage, involves probability, whether it's more likely than not that the defendant would be acquitted if the jury considered the new evidence along with the old evidence, not whether it theoretically could, but whether it probably would. And the defendant has not met that standard, particularly with regard to the Green affidavit, which the trial court correctly ruled was not conclusive. And the reasons for that, for the reasons for the state's argument there are discussed in the answer brief, but briefly, it was a vague and artfully drawn and benign gesture by the defendant's co-defendant. Its well-pleaded factual statements were consistent with the defendant's guilt. The physical evidence at the scene was inconsistent with the defendant's theory on appeal that Green could have inflicted the fatal wound when he swung the knife. No reasonable jury could have believed that Green inflicted the fatal wound without realizing it, or that swinging a knife could inflict a front-to-back stab wound. And even if the jury believed that Green was suggesting that he stabbed or fatally stabbed Clark, Clark was stabbed seven times, six of which were non-fatal, and any suggestion that the affidavit was a confession to murder is positively rebutted by the record. So for these reasons, the reasons people in the answer brief, the people respectfully request that the court affirm.
Okay, thank you. Justice Welsh, question?
No questions.
Okay, Justice Moore?
No questions.
All right, thank you, Ms. Camden. Mr. Whitney, rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. First of all, with respect to the so-called forensic evidence that the court below relied upon in concluding that the Green affidavit was inadequate to raise the probability of actual innocence in which the state has adopted, it was error for the court to step in the role of forensic pathologist and determine that there was an inconsistency between swinging the knife and the one to one and a half inch stabbing wound inflicted on the victim. And it's really a matter of common sense. If someone is swinging a knife like this straight across, yes, it would make a slashing wound. But if someone was swinging a knife like this, it would make a stabbing wound. You know, it clearly could have had that potential. And so for the court below and now the state to argue that someone swinging a knife could not have inflicted the fatal injury just defies common sense and should not be adopted or entertained by this court. And yet that was part of the trial court's rationale in denying the sufficiency of the Green affidavit. With respect to some of the other arguments raised by opposing counsel, there is no rule of law that says that if a witness is included on a witness list and one of those witnesses later comes forward with new information, this somehow proves lack of due diligence. There is no law that says that. And that's because it would be ludicrous to adopt a rule of law like that. The state had 77 witnesses on their witness list. I can't recall off the top of my head how many were on the defense list. They probably adopted the state's list. That's very common. This is very routine. Attorneys do this all the time. They list everybody under the sun that might possibly have any information about the case on their witness list to err on the side of a caution in case they need to call someone later and realize, oh, we need to call this person. It doesn't mean that there's a duty to, you know, to interview every one of these witnesses about every possible flaw in their testimony, and that if you don't do that, that shows lack of due diligence. That is not, there is no rule of law that says that, that does not defeat the claim that this was newly discovered evidence in the context of this case.
What about the state's argument that the Green affidavit was available during the post-conviction proceedings?
Yes, I was just about to get to that, Your Honor. The state does rely on the Weidman and English cases, and as explained in great detail in the brief, that is not the rule of law adopted by our Supreme Court and numerous appellate panels, including the Fifth District, as cited in the reply brief. The rule of law has always been, if it's not available at the time of trial, then it is, and it's material, et cetera, meets the other conclusions, then it's new evidence. What happened in, it began with the English case, is that the English case was first addressing the cause and prejudice test for failure for the late filing of an initial petition. Had nothing to do with the successive petition. And in that context, the court said, well, it was available. This evidence was available at the time of the initial petition. That's relevant to the cause and prejudice test. It is not relevant to the test for filing a successive petition. The English court just happened to repeat the same language that, well, it was available both, you know, before the trial and before the post-conviction petition. So it was basically an innocuous statement. And then the Weidman court took, the Snow court, which came in between English and Weidman, then took that and said, well, if it's available at any post-trial proceeding, then it's not newly discovered. Well, and I explain this in great detail in the reply brief, which I would certainly urge the court to take a close look at as far as how this miscreant rule of law was created. That would clearly defy due process, because a sentencing hearing is a post-trial proceeding. So if a defendant had new evidence at the time of a sentencing hearing, he couldn't introduce it at the sentencing hearing, can't challenge your conviction at a sentencing hearing. But then under this rule of law, he couldn't raise it in a post-conviction petition either, because it was available at the time of sentencing. So the new evidence could never be introduced under this rule. It defies due process. It's not the rule of law. It's not the rule of in Robinson, and it is not the rule of law as adopted by numerous appellate panels since then. I'll have to leave it there because I see my time has expired. I thank you, and we respectfully request that the dismissal of Mr. Thompson's motion for leave to file be reversed. Thank you.
Justice Welch, any questions?
No questions.
Justice Moore?
No questions.
Okay, thank you both for your arguments today. This matter will be taken under advisement. We'll issue an order in due course. Have a great day.